Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. All manner of unorthodoxy today, appropriate to the dislocations of year-end. Branko Marcetic, who wrote a book about Joe Biden, takes a look at his time in office, with a footnote on his broadcast guru, Joe Scarborough. We'll hear a bit of an interview from earlier this year on how to do it better, Edwin Ackerman on AMLO in Mexico. And Santiago Perez will look at how the social composition of elite colleges in the U.S. has changed little over the course of a century. Joe Biden is on the way out, to be succeeded by an absolute horror. It has not been a successful term, and those failures have a lot to do with why we're facing Trump. Biden leaves office with a net approval rating of minus 19, according to 538. 56% disapprove, 37% approve. There was some initial promise. Remember when he was going to be the new FDR? But war, inflation, and deteriorating mental capacity did him in. Here with a review of the Biden years is the Jacobin columnist Branko Marcetic, whose book about him, Yesterday's Man, was published by Verso in 2020. Branko has been writing about the influence of another Joe, Joe Scarborough of MSNBC, on not only the broad liberal consciousness, but on Biden himself. Branko Marcetic. Okay, there are some aspects of Biden's life that do excite some sympathy, the overcoming the stutter, the loss of his wife and kid in a car accident, just like a week or two after he'd been elected to the Senate, and more recently, Beau's death. So before we kick him around some, we should probably acknowledge that there are aspects of his life one can feel some sympathy for, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In many ways, he has overcome a lot. Having your family die in a car accident just before you get inaugurated is no small thing. It's not as if every single thing Biden has ever done in his life and career are awful. And actually, as president, I think there are surprising bright spots in his record. But I say all that to really get to the meat of it, which is that if you look at his career, and I think actually his presidency on balance, it's been an unparalleledly disastrous political career. And his presidency has ultimately, even if it started with some promise and seemed to, for a brief moment, be going in the right direction, ultimately did tremendous damage to the country and actually to the United States as a whole in the world.
Remarkably, he wanted to be president from a very early age, right? He talked about it in his youth.
Yeah, there's various reports from when he was a young man, you know, people that knew him who said that he would immediately tell them, you know, I want to be a senator and maybe one day president. And there was a nun who in some public meetings said that she had an essay that he had written when he was a kid saying he wanted to be president. So in that sense, Biden is very much like a lot of modern U.S. politicians. Obama was this way as well. These are people who start political careers because they want a certain position or a certain status, and not necessarily because they want to actually achieve anything with it. They sort of want this for their own sake, because obviously, you know, being the president of the United States is the most impressive credential you could possibly get. You know, I think that was the case with Hillary Clinton as well. It was just a thing that she wanted to do. And so it's not surprising that throughout their careers, they will end up doing a whole host of terrible things because their main goal, again, is just the pursuit of power for its own sake, not actually trying to enact any sort of political program.
Okay, let's review his political evolution over the decades. In his early days, he was kind of a left populist, economically, otherwise, even an environmentalist, although both within careful limits, right?
Yeah. He started out when he campaigned for the Senate. He ran on a, what you might say, a populist platform. He called out billionaires. He talked about expanding social security. He even talked about a form of national health insurance. You know, how much he actually believed in this, it's debatable. Biden was, number one, fond of taking every position under the sun, depending on who he was talking to. Later on, for instance, in 78, when he ran for re-election for the first time, he, on the one hand, put out a statement when Howard Jarvis, the guy, the anti-tax zealot who was responsible for the anti-tax provision in California that hampered the state for decades, when he endorsed Biden, put out the statement saying, this is great. I welcome this endorsement. That's fantastic. And then later on, when he was speaking to a audience of black voters in Delaware, someone asked him about it. And he said, oh, I'm horrified. I would never, you know, I don't want that. I reject that completely. So he was very good at speaking out of both sides of his mouth throughout his career. That would lead him to take multiple different positions and then also discard them when he felt that they were no longer necessary. So I think that in 1972, some of that popular stuff was a little more appealing to him. And then by the time you get to the late 70s and you get to Reagan, Biden goes, oh, actually, you know, this is the kind of stuff I'm a lot more comfortable with, being a bit more of a deficit hawk and being worried about spending. And so actually this might work out for me. He said this, you know, openly when Reagan is elected.
He didn't waste much time once he got to the Senate in cultivating relationships with business interests. Being from Delaware, he had to deal with DuPont, but he seemed to do that with some enthusiasm. And then he started raising a lot of money from out of state. So his friendliness with business got a pretty early start.
Yeah, well, you know, politics is a money game. And I think, you know, Biden being, again, someone who is in this to climb the ladder and advance, working with business, getting them on side, getting their money, I think that was just part of the game, or at least that's how he saw it. Early on, you can find clips of Biden, you know, clips that have since gone viral, where he talks about how, you know, basically he's asked to quote, prostitute himself, and that all these big guys with big money want him to do whatever he wants. So he's very open about the fact that this is how Washington works. In his early years, he made a kind of token show of trying to rein in some of the stuff. He would put forward bills and support measures aimed at like public financing and restricting corporate donations and politics and that kind of thing. But ultimately, as his career went on, I mean, Biden became only more and more reliant on big money donors, and in a very shameless way, and it got him into a lot of trouble. Interestingly, not in a way where he was necessarily personally profiting from all this stuff, but often what was going on was that his family, brother in particular, but then also later on his son, used his political position, used his name as a way to kind of advance their own particular money-making interests. So it was Biden himself was usually fairly clean, but it was the people around him that he indulged who made use of his position to try and get rich.
As the 80s moved on, he moved to the right, embraced the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, when it was founded to move the party to the right. All that early, you know, leftish leaning stuff disappeared as he became Mr. Deficit Hawk and also Mr. Tough on Crime. He was really one of the leading warriors of the war on crime, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Him and Strom Thurmond. I mean, you know, there was a lot of controversy when Biden talked about how he worked with Strom Thurmond back in 2019 when he said that, because, you know, for obvious reasons, the guy was a unreconstructed segregationist and racist. But the thing that Biden actually worked with Thurmond on was changing the criminal code to, you know, in a more tough on crime direction, and particularly in terms of harsher sentences for anything to do with drugs, even possession. And that's where you start to see in the 80s, you get those clips of Biden bragging about how his bill does everything but hang people for jaywalking. And you know, he says, you know, if you have a rock of crack that's the size of a penny or something along those lines, you know, you'll end up with this many years in jail. One of the bills he supported was also responsible for the crack and powder cocaine discrepancy, which, of course, is now understood as a brazenly racist policy that differentiates cocaine users by what race is most likely to use a certain type of cocaine. Yeah, so he was a big tough-on-crime warrior. That goes back to his early campaign as well. I mean, Biden was always railing against crime and drugs. Those were concerns in the 70s that he played to. And you know, he often also said, like I said, he would talk out of both sides of his mouth, but he would also admit, you know, everyone thinks I'm really liberal, but actually I'm more conservative than they think, and actually I'm secretly a lot more conservative. And so by the time the 80s come, you know, some people read Biden's entire career as he's purely going by where the political winds are going, but I actually think he really was more conservative than people thought. And it's the times that he was in a more progressive direction, if you want to put it that way. I think that was more him chasing the political winds. And once the country turned in a more conservative direction, I think he was able to feel like he was more himself.
Notoriously, he was very much in the pay of the credit card industry, MBNA in particular, and pushed legislation to tighten the bankruptcy code, putting him at odds with Elizabeth Warren. How do you read that? Was it just his home state interest, or was he really some sort of passionate friend of creditors?
MBNA was one of the massive influential businesses in Delaware, and it wasn't just Biden. I mean, every Delaware senator got lots of donations from them. And in Biden's case, it wasn't just donations. I mean, his son got a pretty nice gig at MBNA shortly after he graduated. So clearly they were trying to curry favor with him. I'm sure Biden would have had a number of arguments that he would say to himself to justify what he had done, to justify that that was the right thing. But yeah, I mean, I think this was something that was just pushed by the credit card industry, that not just MBNA, but the entire industry, which a lot of it was headquartered in Delaware. This was another cost Biden was willing to impose on others in his relentless climb up the ladder. And it wasn't the only one. I mean, at the same time, the other disaster of his career was the Iraq War, very much pushed for the same reason.
Yeah, he became a real hawk after 9/11, then gung-ho for invading Iraq. Was he always that way, or is this something changing him?
In his initial campaign for Senate, he was not very clear on his Vietnam stance to begin with. And I think as, number one, as it became an issue, people kind of were saying, wait a minute, what does this guy actually believe about what was maybe the biggest political issue of the day at the time? He had to clarify. And he took on a pretty standard Democratic position for the time, which was, you know, he wanted to withdraw from Vietnam. Once the 80s came, once Reagan gets elected, at the same time as he is basically telling Democrats, we have to change, we have to reject special interests, quote-unquote, meaning black people, unions, LGBTQ people. At the same time he's saying that, he's saying, look, Reagan just won on a more muscular foreign policy. Democrats cannot be afraid to support the use of military force as we have been for the past, you know, decade or so. We have to be just as tough as Reagan. And so from there on, he becomes, yeah, pretty much a real major hawk. I mean, there's few wars that he did not support. I believe he supported the Falklands War. He supported Reagan's various wars, like Grenada, for instance. Of course, during the 90s, he was very big on U.S. intervention in the Balkans. And also, you know, pushed NATO expansion, by the way. One of the themes of Biden's career is that many of the problems that we are dealing with, and in fact he is dealing with, or had to deal with as president, were problems that he himself caused early in his career, but that's another matter. But yeah, and by the time you get to Iraq, obviously post-September 11, people were understandably very angry. They wanted some kind of revenge, and Biden, who was very much the kind of politician to just follow the path of least resistance, looked at that, and I think he said, okay, you know, the thing for me to do here is to basically become a war and terror hawk. And in fact, in 2002, he was facing re-election, and he was facing a very well-financed opponent, well, actually one of the few opponents he had in his career who were able to go toe-to-toe with him in the money stakes, Ray Clatworthy. And this guy Clatworthy hit Biden for being insufficiently loyal to Bush, for not being on board with Bush's foreign policy post 9/11 as he should be. And I think it's not a coincidence that at the same time that is happening, Biden spends that entire year being probably the most prominent Democrat and the most important Democratic voice pushing for the Iraq War.
I'm speaking with the Jacobin columnist Branko Marcetic. And you don't have much in your book about Israel, but how do you read his fervent support for that country? Why is he such a hawk on the Middle Eastern issues?
It's an extremely good question, and it's a question that I am still wrapping my brain around, trying to completely figure out the answer. I mean, initially, actually, there was quite a lot of Israel stuff and other foreign policy stuff in the book about Biden. For space, basically, it had to get cut. I think an important part of the story is this was reported at the time in the 1970s, and also this year I went to look at some archives in Wilmington and found a bunch of Biden documents about his early relationship with Israel and with the local kind of pro-Israel community or lobby, whatever you want to say. Biden in his first campaign, a campaign volunteer quit because he said that Biden had said in this meeting where he wanted a position paper in the Middle East, but he said that his actual views were suicide, his actual views being that Israel should return the occupied territories and that Jerusalem should be an internationalized city. Basically, he said, you know, I can't do that because I'll get raked over the coals and I want to be able to get a bunch of money from people who are pro-Israel in the local community. There was a mini scandal, but it kind of blew over. Biden kind of denied it, but basically all of his people and him kind of said, well, look, yeah, sure, I said some things, but I was playing devil's advocate. And the reporter who actually broke that story, Norm Ornstein, he was a long-time Delaware reporter, she ended up winning a Pulitzer at the Boston Globe. He wrote about it later, and he kind of, the way he wrote about it implied that he thought that Biden had said this kind of thing. It was just obviously a very inconvenient thing to say. Documents from the time, from local pro-Israel groups in Delaware, show that Biden seemed to be taking a pro-Israel position, very much according to what this guy said, based on, you know, basically what local groups want him to say. At one point, actually, he took a position that was actually it was way out of the mainstream. Israel actually should be able to annex the occupied territories or something along those lines. And I think it shows you that, similar to Trump, when he said that doctors who carried abortions should be murdered, the entire right went crazy because they were kind of like, wait, hold on, you're not meant to say that. That's, you know, it was a classic example of someone, of a recent convert, not really knowing the contours of the debate, just trying to posture as just as radical as everyone else. I think that was a big part of it. Clearly, a big part of it was also money. Biden raised a lot of money from pro-Israel donors. When he ran for president in the 80s, a lot of his top staff and a lot of his fundraisers were from AIPAC and other pro-Israel organizations. Politically, his support of Israel during the past year has not made sense. And so it kind of actually clashes. And the fact that he's continued to send arms, even after the election is over, continue to support Israel, basically, whatever it does, that leaves me in a bit of a conflict because I cannot explain this. One possibility is that Biden started out having a very cynical, I'll just say whatever they want me to say kind of attitude. And then over the years, as we all want to do, we all want to explain and justify what we say and do and not believe ourselves to be completely craven. Perhaps Biden really came to believe a lot of the stuff that he was saying in public.
Okay, so now he's about to head out the door. Let's do, you know, the pluses and minuses here. There are some good things. The Inflation Reduction Act had some good stuff in it. The climate, the infrastructure investment, some pro-labor stuff. But foreign policy has been a complete disaster. He's been incredibly bellicose and is bringing the world to the brink of world war. So how would you evaluate the 4 years of Joe Biden on balance here?
You know, I've thought about this a lot. The way that I think about it is that the fact that Biden moved left on certain issues and the fact that we nearly got, for lack of a better term, FDR-like Biden, or at least like Biden's best impression, what FDR might have done, or Biden's best impression of a Bernie Sanders in presidency, even if it didn't really work out, to me that was a testament to, A, the historical moment in which he became president, number one, and number two, it was a testament actually to how effective the left had been, despite the fact that I think, you know, overall the left has been marginalized and a bit muddled in terms of figuring out how to really react and relate to the Biden administration. Clearly, Biden and the people around him, particularly Ron Klain, realized there was energy there, that actually a lot of left-wing arguments had won over the public and that their political interest lay in appealing to that. Unfortunately, that lasted for about a year. And then after that, he went in a very different direction. A lot of claims that Biden ran this populist presidency, that he was a super progressive president, are way overstated. He was actually far more conservative than even in that first year. I mean, you know, it was in 2021 that he openly advocated for ending extended unemployment insurance payments, which if that had been allowed to go for a little longer, imagine how that might have changed people's feelings about the economy and the cost of living that ultimately sunk Biden and the Democrats. It's overstated on domestic policy. On foreign policy, like you said, it's a complete disaster. It's a disaster for anyone on the left who believes in less war, who believes in a smaller U.S. global footprint. But even on its own terms, the terms of kind of U.S. grand strategy and the kind of foreign policy establishment, it's been a total failure. The Ukraine war, which I think Biden started out thinking was going to rescue his presidency when things were flagging, it's a complete debacle. It's not only that it has come close to triggering World War III several different times now, and that it's taken us, by Biden's own words, closer to Armageddon than we have been in decades. It's yet another humiliating black eye for the United States. It's not good for Russia either. I mean, Russia's been humiliated too. Biden, by choosing to prolong the war as long as he has. And that has been a choice. I can go into why that is in more detail, but it has been a choice. It ultimately gave Russia the chance to recover, and now Russia's in the best military position it's been really since the very start of the war. Ukraine is absolutely destroyed. The United States looks very weak because it's ultimately not been able to produce the armaments and equipment needed at the sufficiently large quantities to actually fight this war. And so now it's in this kind of muddled phase where on the one hand, they don't want to make peace because that would look bad after the past 2 years of rhetoric. On the other hand, they also don't really want to push things to a point where it actually leads to a U.S.-Russia confrontation. So it's sort of just in this confusing, aimless, I wouldn't even say stalemate because Russia is slowly winning, but it's just in this kind of stasis at the moment. So that's Ukraine. On the China front, Biden has amped up what Trump did throughout his 4 years and increased confrontation with China, similar to what happened with Ukraine and Russia. Biden has deliberately and repeatedly tested the red line that China has drawn around Taiwan, almost daring them to do something drastic. You've seen massive military budgets that are completely contrary to the goals of the IRA, the climate bill, by the way. Those two things are totally at loggerheads. But you've seen massive military budgets passed. And then also this kind of economic warfare with China. Instead of kind of pushing us towards an easy but cooperative relationship with China, Biden has basically set the framework for a Cold War, a new Cold War with a new adversary. And of course, with Israel and the Middle East, I mean, that's been a complete disaster because that has taken U.S. standing to lows that polling is not clear on this, but there is some evidence that the view of the U.S. in the Middle East and other parts of the world is now worse than it was as a result of the Iraq war. Because, you know, it's not just that this is such a disgusting, repulsive war. War is not really even the word for it. It's a human extermination campaign that Biden has stubbornly supported. But beyond that, it's the trampling over international law, the undermining of the UN, the U.S. has enabled and actually participated in. Biden's 3 years leading up to this, where he was trying to claim the mantle of global leadership for the U.S. against a China that was supposedly undermining this order, has now completely been unraveled. It's been unraveled by Israel, most of all, by the war in Gaza, but I would say also the Ukraine war at the same time. I think people more and more view the United States as a completely irresponsible hegemon and do not really accept any of this rhetoric about U.S. leadership. So it's been a disaster on the terms of the anti-war left, but it's also been a disaster on its own terms by undermining U.S. kind of geopolitical goals.
All right, let's conclude by talking a bit about another Joe Scarborough, who has had an influence on the big Joe in the Oval Office. I was really surprised when I read one of your articles that his audience is under a million people. There are podcasts with larger audiences than that. So what is the root of his influence?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you know, it's not ultimately in audience numbers. I mean, I've talked to people who all say part of the Morning Joe power is that a lot of influential people watch that show when they get up in the morning. And part of that is to do with the guests they book and all kinds of things. This is a well-known thing. It's people who are Washington insiders. They love the show. It's not just Washington insiders, but you know, maybe the most important Washington insider, at least in the last 4 years, Joe Biden. He apparently loves the show, watches it religiously. He apparently even talks to Joe Scarborough off the air, gets advice about stuff, which, you know, you can see the logic there. Scarborough is a former Republican who now hosts a morning show on a liberal network with his Democratic wife. And so Scarborough for Biden represents the idea of the swing voter, or at least, you know, some sort of kind of independent voter. Even though Joe Scarborough, if you actually look at what he believes, is completely off the charts compared to what your average swing voter in America believes in, which is, you know, generally a little more anti-interventionist, more economically populist. You know, Scarborough's very much a neoliberal and a huge, huge hawk. So, yeah, I mean, its power lies in the fact that the president, the White House, and the people that populate it all watch that show and glean insights from it.
And like many Dems, Scarborough was a big cheerleader for the Biden economy, despite lots of discontent. He's one of these people saying, greatest economy ever, and all you people who are complaining just don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny to me. Every time anything happens, it's always blamed on misinformation post-2016. Misinformation is just the catch-all thing that you can use to explain anything and everything. But of course, you know, Biden or Kamala Harris loses, and you start to get this wave of articles and statements and interviews from people saying, oh, this is all misinformation, people are lied to, this is a huge problem. And I actually agree with that, but I agree with it in a very different way. I think the misinformation that caused or helped cause this election result was coming from people like Scarborough and from other people on MSNBC and from a host of well-read pundits, widely read within the D.C. establishment, whose main message and advice to the Biden White House and into the Harris campaign was, don't take any notice of people complaining about the economy and complaining about how they don't feel financially secure. They're wrong. The economy is great. Look at these two or three statistics that we're going to focus on and nothing else. And you don't really have to do anything about this except tell people how great everything is and what a great job you've done. At least until, I would say, maybe early 2024, that's basically what the Biden administration did. It just ignored people's suffering. Biden just went out there and told people about the same laundry list of bills that he's been telling people about, you know, for the past year. And it didn't work, shockingly. It turns out that when people are unhappy, you can't just tell them that they're wrong. But that is what the Joe Scarboroughs of the world were advising Biden and his people to do.
And, of course, he was intensely pro-Israel, never a Palestinian voice in the show.
Yeah, I did this, put myself through the ordeal of watching 6 months' worth of Morning Joe segments on the Gaza war. There's so many striking things about it. But, of course, the fact that there was not a single Palestinian guest, not a single one. I asked them, I said, am I missing something? Is there anyone you can point to that you've had on the show? They didn't get back to me. The one exception, there was a brief video of a Palestinian mother very early in the war. It was part of a segment, so she was not interviewed in the studio. It was just a video that they played for about 20 seconds. And there was the son of a Hamas founder who has been an Israeli intelligence informant for many years, who was virulently pro-Israel. That was probably the most prominent Palestinian voice they had. It was a pro-Israel Palestinian voice that was very much in favor of the war and very much saying things like, you know, if anyone dies in this war, it's Hamas's fault. That shows you how skewed the perspective on that conflict would be for anyone who watches that show religiously.
So how is Scarborough going to deal with the Trump era?
It's a big question if they're even going to survive into the Trump era. What exactly they're going to do? Because they, after Trump won, they had called him Hitler. I mean, literally, they said he was like Hitler. They warned that all this terrible stuff was going to happen. And then he wins, and suddenly they're in a difficult position. And they make the horrible miscalculation to go down to Mar-a-Lago, talk to Trump, try and sort of curry favor with him, because they're supposedly scared of having some kind of retribution against him from the incoming administration. And then they announce it on TV, and immediately, I mean, as in real time, their audience drops. And, you know, they've kind of humiliated themselves. They've discredited themselves. And so the big question is, does this show even survive? Or do they try and find some other sort of home that's outside of MSNBC? I mean, because even MSNBC itself, just in general, the channel seems to be falling out of favor with audiences and with NBC itself, which wants to separate itself from the kind of democratic machine portion of its programming. So, yeah, we will see. But it doesn't look great for the hosts.
That was Branko Marcetic, who writes regularly for Jacobin. His book, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden, was published by Verso in 2020. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Patti Smith doing Hey Joe, one of many covers of a song of murky origins. This was digitized, surface noise and all, from my copy of the original 1974 single. A reminder that it's possible to do better, a reprise of some of my interview with the Syracuse University sociologist Edwin Ackerman from June about the presidency of Mexico's Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO. AMLO left office at the end of September, massively popular, handing over power to his successor, Claudia Sheinbaum, who had won her election in a landslide. This is a brief excerpt from a much longer interview. Edwin Ackerman. I was just looking at the economic stats the other day, and on paper they look quite orthodox. Pretty high interest rates, budget surplus. I guess this is all part of that whole program of Republican austerity. But evidently it worked pretty well, and people are pleased. So how do we reconcile something that on paper looks pretty conservative with results that look quite populist?
There's, on the one hand, at the macroeconomic level, a certain orthodoxy. I would add that if you compare that to, let's say, Lula, at least, you know, in the first two terms, you could see a similarity there where there's a certain orthodoxy at the macroeconomic level, and then the interesting stuff, as it were, is happening at different levels of the economy. And I think what's happening in Mexico is that there is the significant push, and now we can also show actual outcomes in that sense in favor of the working classes. There's a significant decrease in poverty, and more importantly, that decrease in poverty concentrates in the working poor. Now, the policies are a mix, on the one hand, of cash transfer programs, but also a significant push in favor of workers' rights, including things like historic increase to the minimum wage, elimination of precarious hiring practices known as outsourcing, facilitation of the formation of new unions, and a series of other things along that route that have had that effect on the economy. In addition to that, I would say that there is this big push for the state to be a developmentalist agency. And this has taken the form primarily of embarking in what the government calls mega projects, or what people in the country know as mega projects. These are big infrastructure projects that involve things like airports, trains, refineries, etc. And all of this done under the pre-neoliberal logic of public works. There's a huge kind of pumping into the economy in a way that goes directly to people at the bottom. How to reconcile that with the macroeconomics? I mean, I think there's two things going on there. On the one hand, there is a certain overcorrection, if you will, by AMLO and other figures of the pink tide, that they come to power after decades of neoliberalism, where one of the big selling points of neoliberalism, if it was true or not, is a separate matter. It wasn't, but a selling point was its orthodoxy, its fiscal orthodoxy, right? That it was a much more stable system, you know, that was moving away from inflationary pressures and so on. And I think some of his leaders, and AMLO included, come to power already trying to foreshadow that this will be a line of critique, and they are, again, overcorrecting in that sense. The other thing to add is that he has a very specific understanding of neoliberalism, which moves away from the idea that neoliberalism was the contraction of the state in the service of the free market. It's a view that really emphasizes a retooling or reinstrumentalization of the state in the service of, not even of the market in some abstract sense, but in the service of private interests specifically. And so the idea has always been that, to put it in his own terms, that the money is there, but it was all siphoned off through corruption, so that if you eliminate that, you can use all that money to embark in this effort.
Now, the view of neoliberalism, it's true that this idea that was just the clawing back of the state is incorrect because there's use of state power to pursue very specific goals. But AMLO is also trying to, or has been trying to, undo that ideology about the state and to rebuild state capacity that was hollowed out and just change people's attitudes about politics. How successful was he on that agenda?
You know, I think at this point, for example, it is taboo for any mainstream party to call itself neoliberal or to, at least at the discursive level, campaign with those flags. That in itself, just at the level of discourse, or you could say at the level of political culture, is a significant success. This is sort of, you know, equivalent to when Margaret Thatcher said that her biggest success was the New Labour Party, right? It's the idea that the basic parameters of debate, at least discursively, are shifted as an effect of that.
That was Edwin Ackerman from a June interview. And now a look at the reproduction of our elite higher education branch. My next guest, Santiago Perez, is one of four authors of a study published in November as a working paper by the National Bureau of Economic Research on the social structure of elite colleges in the U.S. over the last century. Much of the data they used in the study was impressively hand-assembled from university and census documents. Not to spoil the suspense, but their conclusion is that while these institutions, who pump out the people who govern us, employ us, and shape how we think, have diversified racially and geographically over the last century, they have changed little in their economic makeup. The student bodies still come from predominantly upper-income families, just as they did in the day of the fictional Yaley Dink Stover 112 years ago. Santiago Perez is an associate professor of economics at the University of California at Davis. Before we get into details of your findings, tell us how you did this research. You didn't just download some time series and run regressions on them like many economic papers do. How did you produce this data?
Actually, we started working on this data collection right before the pandemic. So I think it was February of 2020. It took us quite a long time. So basically what we did was to identify a set of colleges that we wanted to study. So, we came up with this list of 65 universities. And then we had to basically locate the records for each of these universities. That took some time because it's not like a centralized website or anything like this where you can just go. So, we had to talk to librarians in different universities, search online, send people to libraries, etc. Then we digitized all this data. And then we matched this data to the population census. So it was a pretty big data lift, probably the biggest I've done in my career so far. But, hopefully it's going to lead to a lot of other projects, in addition to the one that we released a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and I guess there's a lot of material here, so you and other researchers can work on it.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot, and we're going to have a few other follow-up related projects coming in the next year, but even earlier. So we're doing also some work on this issue of legacy admissions in the long run, which we think is going to be quite interesting because the data that we have allow us to identify which college you went, but also which college your parents and even your grandparents attended. So we can look at this persistence of families in certain colleges over time in a way that it's just not possible with other sources. We can look at this over a much longer run persistence, which we think is going to be quite exciting.
Okay, over the last century or so, there's been a huge increase in the share of population going to college, but the elite institutions remain pretty segregated by family income. So let's talk about the big picture. How have things changed or not changed over the last century in the makeup of the college population?
So, if you look at, what percent of the population goes to college, that has certainly increased in a very dramatic way. So, among people born early in the 20th century, maybe less than 10% would ever go to college. If you look at the people that are starting college today, people born in the early 2000s or so, these people, maybe 70% of people would eventually go to college. It doesn't mean that they will graduate necessarily, but, in terms of attendance, having at least some college education, this is something that has really, quote-unquote, democratized massively in the U.S. It's part of a bigger, longer-run trend in, people having just more education today than in the past. So it first happened with high school, then with college. But then if we kind of zoom in on this more like highly selective colleges, we see that these changes are much more muted in terms of access. So, one implication of the fact that much more people go to college is that, a different set of people start going to college, in particular, people from lower income backgrounds. One focuses on the broader college going population. But when we zoom in on these highly selective colleges, the picture is really quite different, and we see that the representation of people at kind of the bottom of the income distribution has remained pretty stable over time at relatively low levels, in the order of, around 5% of all students at these colleges come from the bottom 20%. So, in a world where each group is represented as its share in the population, this would be 20%, but it's just 5%. We do see that in the elite colleges, there are some interesting changes in the relative representation of the upper and the middle class, where even though the proportion of people from the bottom is very stable over time,
this relative representation of the middle and the top has changed over time. But in particular, we see that early in the 20th century, people from the middle class account for a very small fraction of people in these elite colleges. And that seems to increase after World War II, leading to the 1970s and early 80s. And since then, there is this kind of reversal where, people from the middle class are a similar fraction today than what they were in the early 20th century, even though they were a higher proportion in kind of these mid-century cohorts.
Who took their place?
So basically, it's kind of a reversal. The bottom is very flat. So basically, any place that is, any position that the middle class is losing is basically taken by people at the top of the income distribution. So it's kind of the top 20% recovering its sort of very high levels of representation compared to early 20th century. So it's basically this kind of, if you think of this as it's sort of this U-shaped representation of the top 20%, where it's higher at the beginning of the century, then it declines, then it reverses back to its high World War II levels.
Yeah, I was one of these people who went to Yale in the 1970s, and I was part of that Inky Clark recruit the middle class kids from public schools campaign. And the place did just not reek of money the way it does now. The Ivies, at least my understanding of Yale from a distance, it's just so much more moneyed than it used to be. And I guess this is part of the story, that there's much more upper class representation there than there were 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, a lot of people we talked to, they seem that went through some of these colleges in this relatively more egalitarian period in the, like 60s and 70s, they seem to have this impression that things were a little bit different back then. Another kind of important development that is on the background is that overall levels of income inequality in the U.S. are changing quite a lot, right? So it's a period where inequality is also going up quite substantially. So if you compare, the early 80s to, the more recent period, and that also has implications for, not just the representation of the top 20%, but how wealthy is the top 20% relative to other parts of the distribution. So, nowadays, that gap between, the top of the distribution and the middle is much larger than what it used to be in the 70s or so. And we see that that's perhaps underlying some of our findings, is that, if you think of a world where there is higher inequality, the incentives for families to invest in this, what we might call this admissions race, are going to be much stronger than in a world where, where income inequality is lower, because it's just, the stakes associated with going to one of these elite colleges are just going to be much more dramatic, much more consequential.
Now, what about race and geography? That's changed, even if income has not so much.
Yes, the story there is quite different. So if you look at access by race, so these institutions are essentially white institutions up until the kind of, civil rights era. So if you look at, what percent of students at these elite private colleges are black, it's essentially very close to zero. In the paper, we talk about this relative representation that you should think of, not just the proportion of blacks, but, the proportion of blacks relative to the proportion in the general population. And that relative representation is close to zero leading up to the 60s. Then there is a pretty big spike following kind of the civil rights era. And then there is sort of, if you look at, relative representation of blacks, it's not too different today than what it was 50 years ago. So the progress, the kind of the changes there are much more discrete in time, where, things are flat for a long period, then there is a big spike in the 60s, and then things remain relatively stagnant in terms of relative representation, where blacks in these elite private colleges have a relative representation of about 0.6, 0.7, where one would represent the same representation that in the general population. Now, if you look at geography, these colleges have become much more national and even international in scope. So earlier in the 20th century, these are, still overwhelmingly serving a local population. So, people at Harvard are mostly from the Northeast in the early 20th century. Today, these schools are much more national in scope and increasingly also international. So we see, a much higher proportion of people coming from outside the country.
Okay, so there are two policies over the last several decades that were supposed to democratize college attendance, the GI Bill and the SAT, standardized tests. They didn't work so well. Describe how they didn't work so well and why. First, the GI Bill. We have this idea that brought in the masses, but it didn't.
Yeah, so we think that, at least to me, the GI Bill results were the most surprising. So, you know, if one reads the popular press about, you know, if one goes to ChatGPT and asks, you know, what were the effects of the GI Bill? You know, did it increase the representation of lower income people in elite colleges? I think the answer would be overwhelmingly yes. So here the conventional wisdom is really that these policies have, you know, a very strong democratizing effect in terms of accessing higher education. When we look at the data, we see that it doesn't seem to do much in terms of changing the relative representation of different income groups in these elite colleges. Now, the way we do this is that, you know, we use the fact that, you know, depending on which exact quarter of the year you were born, you have a very different probability of serving in World War II. So basically, people born in the last quarter of 1927 had, you know, a very high chance of going to the war. People born in the first quarter is a much lower probability. So basically, what we say is, well, you know, if the GI Bill is changing the socioeconomic composition of these elite colleges, what we should see is that people that were very likely to be veterans, they should look poorer than people that are very unlikely to be veterans. So that's a basic test that we do. And what we see is that these people actually look very similar to each other. So even though it's true that that a lot of the people at these elite colleges are indeed World War II veterans, so particularly in this, you know, in this birth cohort, so, you know, like close to 90% of people born in the last quarter of 1927 did serve in the war. It's a very high proportion of veterans in these colleges, but these veterans actually are coming from families that are not very different from the families where the non-veterans are coming from. So if you look at the elite private colleges, this is basically what's going on. If you look at the elite public ones, there's even a decline in the relative representation of people from the bottom, which is, you know, even more shocking at some level. But now if you think about the data and the setting, it's not totally surprising if one looks at the data in some detail. And, you know, one needs to remember that a relatively low proportion of people in this time period even completed high school. So, and rates of high school completion are also unequally distributed, you know, depending on parental income. So if one looks at people born at the bottom 20% of the income distribution, about one third of kids had completed high school at that point in this relevant birth cohort. So in a way, the set of people that could really benefit from these subsidies, from the college subsidies, is not very large if one focuses at the bottom of the income distribution. So this is a subsidy that in a way is quite regressive, because the set of people that can really benefit are not really the people at the bottom, and that's why you end up seeing that, you know, the representation doesn't really increase much, and if anything, some evidence that it goes down in the public colleges.
Okay, and now the SAT, that people who criticize the SAT say it just reinforces discrimination, but people who defend it say it's supposed to be a democratizing technique. What does your work say?
Yeah, so this is a sort of a bit of a favorite topic of mine, and actually one where it was really one of the initial motivations for this project was looking at the SAT, and you know, this was back in 2020 where a lot of colleges were canceling the SAT on the basis of, you know, this exam is leading to inequities in higher education, etc. You know, a lot of colleges went ahead and canceling the SAT, you know, during the pandemic. And then, you know, in recent years, we see kind of the opposite trend where a lot of colleges are bringing back the SAT. And what to me was sort of fascinating is that sort of some of the arguments both in favor of removing the SAT and of bringing it back are basically the same arguments. So saying, you know, the SAT is good for equity. And, you know, of course, it can be both. But I found it interesting that there was this discussion going on. But kind of going back to the paper, what we do is, we look at the first introduction of the SATs in American colleges. And here what we see is that the SAT actually doesn't do much. So it's both, you know, we see it really doesn't increase the representation of people from poorer families, but it also doesn't hurt that representation. So in that sense, you know, our paper is really not evidence in favor of either of these two sides. So it's really saying that, you know, this doesn't seem to do much. And, you know, there are a number of reasons why this might happen. But, you know, one is that one needs to remember that the SAT in the U.S. context is used in a very different way than standardized exams are used in other countries. So there are countries where entry exams for college are basically the only metric that the higher education system is using. So these are systems where, you know, it's purely based on, you know, if you're above a certain cutoff, you make it. If you are below, you don't. In the U.S., standardized exams have pretty much always been used as part of this more holistic assessment of students. So in a way, you know, one way to think about it is that, you know, maybe the SAT didn't really change too much the ranking of applicants that colleges would have produced anyway. And as a consequence, it ended up not doing much in terms of students' social backgrounds.
Why and how much do elite colleges matter? Why should people care about this?
So it's a great question. I think that one reaction that one might have is, well, you know, these colleges, you know, at the end of the day, they're enrolling such a small proportion of the population, and it's actually a shrinking proportion of the population if one looks at the longer run. So, you know, why should we care about where, you know, 0.1% of the population goes to college? And that's kind of one reason why we shouldn't care. But I think that if one looks at people in positions of economic and political power, you know, these elite colleges still are producing a lot of these economic and social elites. So if you want to understand, you know, who is making it to the elite, understanding these colleges, you know, we think it's crucial. And, you know, it is indeed the case that, you know, if one looks at members of the Supreme Court to members of Congress to CEOs to, you know, you name it, like, you know, people in positions of economic and political power, you know, these colleges are massively overrepresented and account for an important fraction of this elite. So, you know, that's why, you know, even though in a pure demographic sense they are small, you know, they're quite big in terms of their impact in American society.
And as you point out, in a country or society where income inequality is increasing, but also the consequences of failure seem to be harsher than ever, it really does matter. Every little advantage you can get really counts a lot.
Yes, and I think that, the, you know, if one thinks about a lot of the recent research on inequality, you know, Piketty's size, you know, work from the early 2000s emphasizes what happens at the very top of the income distribution as an important driver of these overall trends in inequality. In a way, this means that, you know, as social scientists, you know, understanding what's happening at the very top should be part of, you know, what we care about, you know, if we want to understand these kind of broader societal trends in terms of, you know, income inequality, intergenerational mobility, etc.
I'm Santiago Perez, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of California, Davis, and co-author of an NBER working paper on the social origins of the student bodies of elite colleges. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Roxy Music's Street Life. Till next week, bye.